significant action other than technical stuff. So.
Here we go, sir.
Good afternoon, everyone. Today is the 25th of April, 2017. This is the Subcommittee on Transportation and Economic Development. A quorum being present, I'm going to go ahead and convene this meeting today. And I am going to also convene a public hearing on House Bill 5039, which is the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs budget, the Phase 2 discussion. Before we get started, I just wanted to recognize that I see in the audience today a number of members from the Veterans of Foreign Wars. I want to thank all of you for being here and for your service to our country. We appreciate that more than we can say. We are scheduled today for invited testimony only, and I'm going to ask Ms. Beidle to just give us an update on where we're at, and then I'm going to invite Commissioner Hall to be our first presenter today.
All right. Thank you, Co-Chair Gomberg, members of the subcommittee. Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs is back for the second phase of the hearings on their budget. This is the first of 2 days the department will be before the subcommittee. The focus of their phase two presentation is the investment of the lottery funding available to the department through the passage of Measure 96. Specifically, the department will go into more detail into three of their proposals included in policy option packages. Policy option package 102, targeting veteran services, included two components the department will discuss: increased funding for the county veteran service officers, as well as a realignment of funding for veteran services from home loan program revenues to lottery funds. And the department will also go into more detail for policy option package 104, mobilizing partnerships, which proposed to expand and enhance services to veterans in the areas of education, health, and mental health, and homelessness and housing.
Very good. Well, Commissioner Hall, if you'd like to come forward while you're coming up. Members, I just wanted to point out for you that I noticed we have just begun the annual display of the Military Uniform Museum in the Rotunda, just a portion of the 1,500 uniforms that they have in their collection, together with the biographies of the men and women that have worn those uniforms, well worth a little bit of time. Commissioner Hall, welcome to the committee. If you could introduce yourself for the record, we'd be pleased to hear from you.
Thank you very much, Chair Gomberg and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Bill Hall. I live in Newport. I am a member of the Lincoln County Board of Commissioners, and I'm here today in my role as president of the Association of Oregon Counties for 2017. And I want to talk for just a couple of minutes about the wonderful partnership, the very strong partnership that exists between counties and the County Veteran Service Officer Program and the State of Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs. I think most, if not all of you, are already aware of the fact that our county veteran service officers are truly the boots on the ground at the front lines. They're there to help the men and women who have served our country navigate the often Byzantine Veterans Administration systems so they can obtain the disability, health care, and other benefits that they not only deserve, but they have earned. There's really no substitute or secret to success. When we have more well-trained CVSOs, we'll file more claims of high quality in terms of documentation. More claims will be able to lead to more benefits. And I believe in the materials that have been submitted to you on behalf of AOC is a resolution that AOC passed. It was the very first resolution under my leadership as president this year, calling on the governor, calling on the legislature to fully fund veterans programming in the coming biennium. Essentially, the bargain that was made with the voters of Oregon and that they approved rather overwhelmingly in their approval of ballot measure 96, the expectation that $18.5 million in lottery funds would be added to the existing $10 million in general fund services. So what I'm here today in specifically to encourage you to consider is an increase in the current service level for the county VSO program from its current $4.7 million to ask for $7.3 million in additional ballot measure 96 funding, which would bring total funding for the CVSO program to $12 million. Now, that is an ask for only 39% of the $18.5 million in new money. And when we talk about return on investment, we have an amazing untapped potential, I believe. You'll also find this information sheet, which was produced by Veterans Affairs. In round numbers, we're talking about a $78,000 a year cost for a VSO and an annual estimated average payments to veterans per VSO, $1.7 million. You'll see a comparison between Oregon and Oklahoma. The reason Oklahoma was selected as our comparator, they only have a veterans population 9,000 greater than Oregon's, yet they're receiving $1.8 billion a year in compensation and pension revenue versus $1.3 billion a year for Oregon. $500 million we're leaving on the table. I really believe that we could easily capture with a more robust system. You know, and we've got not only that example, but we've got the example that previous legislatures have done by increasing funding for the system. Since 2007, the last big infusion of new money, federal dollars coming into the state have almost doubled in that time. And remember, we're not talking about a one-time boost. These predominantly are lifelong benefits. And again, if you'll take a look at this infographic, because in either case, each state is only capturing a tiny proportion of the total number of eligible veterans. Right now in Oregon, we're only capturing 3 out of 10. So more trained VSOs on the ground throughout the state, we have the opportunity to not only bring these men and women the benefits they've earned and deserved, but to bring a tremendous ongoing infusion into our economy. So that's my pitch. I thank you for your consideration. I'd be happy to answer questions if you have any.
And I believe Senator Johnson does.
Let me start, colleagues, by apologizing. I was stuck on a telephone call. Commissioner Hall, I was thinking about you last night. I watched a McCall.
Oh, thank you.
Documentary. I think in no small regard, you're preaching to the converted with respect to this committee and our knowledge of our own CVSOs and the work that they're doing and the federal drawdown that they're bringing to the state of Oregon. This is a trivial question, but it's one that I'd like to get into the mix, particularly with the director sitting right over your shoulder. And that is to figure out how we are able to regularize the compensation and the working environment for the CVSOs. We're talking about a substantial amount of money, I hope, going to CVSOs. And I remain convinced that they have more caseload that they can handle. I am convinced, unless somebody tells me otherwise, that their employment relationships are sort of episodic. In my district, they work for the community action team.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing is that I was aware in one of the counties that I represent that the CVSO ended up fronting money personally before the paycheck caught up with them. And I think, and I'm asking the professional staff to capture this, I don't know whether or not it upsets the apple cart to try to regularize those relationships in a way that a CVSO in Lincoln County has the expectation for the same work environment, the same remuneration, the same support that they would in Columbia or Clatsop. And I don't know how yours is structured in Lincoln County, if your CVSO is an employee of the county or works through a not-for-profit. I don't know. I think they're all structured slightly differently.
Yeah.
And the level of work they're doing, the consistent attitude that I've seen across the core of CVSOs of this, we are going to get every last dime the veteran was promised and earned. Those people are heroic, and I just want to make sure that we're treating them with equity.
Senator, I absolutely agree. You know, most of the CVSOs I know, no, I'll say all of them, it's not a job to them. It's a calling. It's a sacred calling. And they give it their all and then some. You know, I can't speak to other counties. I believe in the majority of cases, but not all cases. They are county employees. I know the Harney County CVSO, I believe, is employed by a nonprofit in Lincoln. When I was elected in 2005, we had one CVSO working 4 days a week. Now we have two full-time folks, and, you know, despite their heroic efforts, they found themselves really getting backed up. And so as at least a short-term solution, which hopefully this new money could help us address even more effectively, we brought in work-study students to provide clerical support to them. But, you know, that's short-term. You just get somebody trained up, and their period in work-study is done. So maybe could we call on the director? I'm not really sure what the state is doing at this point in terms of monitoring the employment and support situation and regularizing that, but I think the counties would certainly be open to participating in a discussion along those lines.
I'm going to ask the director to hold for just a minute. I wanted to pursue in a little more depth, Commissioner.
Sure.
This committee has talked before about the point that you raised today, and that is that we're only enrolling perhaps three or at best four out of 10 veterans that are here in Oregon in the system that we have here and helping them to receive the benefits that they have properly earned and are so well entitled to. Your argument is that with increased funding to local and county level CSOs, that we're going to do a better job of reaching out to that to that population group that we have not yet reached. And I appreciate that argument, but I wonder if you could give us a little more detail of how you see that might be working. If we give you more money at the county level, how are you going to reach out to the folks that we haven't connected with yet?
I think it's, you know, one of the challenges for Oregon, unlike Oklahoma, I'll say one way in which we differ, you know, Oklahoma is a state with military bases. In Oregon, we don't have bases. We're primarily, you know, men and women are coming home from National Guard service. So I guess I would say it's not, there aren't as many opportunities for wholesale outreach, you know, enrollment in services as part of discharge. It's really got to be one-on-one in the community, going and meeting with men and women in the community and how many different venues our CVSOs can think of. Again, as I said, I'm not a vet, but the son, grandson of vets, I've gotten to know a lot of vets. And one thing, you know, that I found myself a few years ago wondering why we were only reaching 3 in 10. You've earned the benefits. Why aren't you asking for them? And I think in at least a story I hear variations on again and again is, I think the best way, one veteran told me, you know, his service, it's a long story, but essentially it was not a good experience. It was very traumatizing. So he said, I just packed that phase of my life away in a box and wanted to forget all about it, you know. And so I think that's going to take some nurturing. And you know, the figures from that we have, it's not going to happen overnight. It's going to take some work, but I think within a biennium or two we would start to see some real results, just if more people have more time, more opportunity to knock on doors, go to coffees, go to VFW meetings, Legion meetings, sportsman club meetings, one-on-one outreach.
Let's follow up on that a little bit further, Commissioner, and And I'll remind the committee, we had some, I think, rather poignant and perceptive details from Representative Evans when he was before this committee talking about the subject of outreach as well. But you talk about getting out and going to these coffees and going to some of these other community events. It's my sense that at least in our own county, because mm-hmm. I'm from Lincoln County myself, that our VSO officers, at least in the past, have had their hands full at the office.
Exactly.
And have not had an opportunity to get out into the community, particularly in a county like our own, which has half a dozen distinct communities. Mm-hmm. And the veterans that we're trying to reach out to often are transportation disadvantaged as well as being disadvantaged in other ways, and they can't get to the office in Newport. And our VSO in the past, when I was trying to work with him, was getting out once every 2 weeks to another community. Do you see mm-hmm. these additional resources as getting us away from the office more?
I think so. I mean, you know, if you know, I'm speaking in hypotheticals, and I can't at this point, and I can't bind my fellow commissioners at this point, but say for Lincoln County, I think a very reasonable proposal, if we had a third position, would be to station that person not in the Newport office, but full-time in Lincoln City, as an example. And I think other counties, you know, depending on geography, capacity, and need, we could encourage them to look at similar approaches.
Other questions for Commissioner Hall? Yes, Representative.
Thank you, Co-Chair. Commissioner Hall, good to see you again. Thank you for being here. I'm going to ask
you
something that's really obvious probably to everybody else in the room except me. I don't know specifically what it means by capturing. So I'm not sure it's clear to me, and I apologize, it should be. Specifically, what do you have to do to capture a vet?
I think just make the personal connection, make them aware the office is there. Again, you know, I'll go back to what Representative Gomberg has said, that the two gentlemen in our Lincoln County office, that frankly, you know, they haven't done a lot of outreach because they simply have been extremely busy dealing with all their walk-in traffic. But I think first letting veterans who aren't aware that the office is there, let them know that it exists, what they can do. You know, a common misconception I find, you know, people will refer to it as the VA office, and if somebody's had a bad experience with the Veterans Administration, you know, I remember my father, who was a 90% disabled World War II Marine veteran, spent his whole life battling the VA for the veterans, the benefits that he had earned. So having them understand that whether they're a county employee, a local nonprofit, or that they're not a VA employee, which I think is very significant, because they're there as the veterans advocate. They will do the paperwork for them to submit the claim to the VA, and if they have to appeal that and you know, fight for them in the system, they will do that. So letting them know that the office exists, what services are available, what their role is, and just getting them in the door. You know, I've heard of some counties, for example, that have launched, you know, this is an interesting idea. Yamhill has had some success with a veteran's ID card, and they get local businesses to offer, you know, say a 5% or 10% discount to anybody who shows this veteran's card. And they say, you know, that gets more people in the door who never even knew the office existed, because they go in to apply for the card and they say, oh, gee, what's this all about? Who are you guys? And so, you know, that's an outreach tool. And I think there are some other innovative outreach tools. We try to use our AOC Veterans Committee for sharing of best practices, and the State Association, I'm sure, does the same. But, you know, just kind of letting people know they're there.
So, you can, Rick. I'm sorry. Just follow up.
This may be a really good argument for mm-hmm. giving you more funding, but mm-hmm. So I'm a Vietnam and Vietnam era vet.
Mm-hmm.
I have no idea what services I might be missing out on. I've been very blessed. I've not needed medical. I had a GI loan. You know, I got through college on that.
Mm-hmm.
But I have no idea what services I might be leaving on the table, or if I would be. So I think that's a good argument for we need to do more of this work. Mm-hmm. So if you have somebody like me that I feel like I haven't needed this, am mm-hmm. I on your target list?
Definitely.
Do you want to capture me?
Definitely.
Nobody has ever tried to take this hill.
Yeah, and maybe if you don't need services now, perhaps at some point in the future you will. And so if you're aware the office is there, you build the relationship, know what they can do, that when the time comes, if you do need services, it won't be as much of a challenge to access them.
Yeah. Senator Monroe.
Thank you. I remember my father, who was a college professor starting during World War II and then after, used to say that the best students he ever had were the young men that came back from World War II. They were the most serious, studious students that he ever had in his almost 40-year teaching mm-hmm. career. And then in 2005, I was elected to the Mount Hood Community College Board. Mm-hmm. And I checked on how many veterans were coming to Mount Hood Community College, because I knew that we were preparing the returning vets for good jobs, good family wage jobs. Mm-hmm. And I found out there weren't very many coming at all. And I wondered why that was. And so I did some investigating, and I found out that many of them didn't have the discretionary money to pay for the first term of classwork so that they could then get their GI Bill money, which came after they had completed a term. And so I got the college to donate the first term's tuition, and we quadrupled the number of veterans within a short time that we were serving.
Wonderful.
There are 17 community colleges in this state. They're all over. And it seems to me that one of the things that the Veterans Administration ought to be emphasizing is working with community colleges to do the kind of thing mm-hmm. that Mount Hood Community College did, so as to provide our returning veterans with a quality job training type education.
Hear, hear. I'd be in a 100% agreement in that. Perhaps if we do get a new position in Lincoln County, perhaps they could be stationed at Oregon Coast Community College's North Campus.
Excellent. Senator Johnson, you had a question.
I was just going to add to the capture conversation that what we have discovered in Columbia County is a veteran-friendly place, so they don't feel as though they're walking into an office building or a antiseptic bureaucratic place. With the help of a local activist, they've established the Veterans Bunker, which was done in coordination with a fraternal organization, the Elks. Mm-hmm. And it is by vets, for vets, and it's a kind of clubhouse for veterans, and they mm-hmm. like it, and it has encouraged the number of vets that are willing to reach out and make contact with the CVSOs.
Yeah, I know in Lincoln County, our office is in leased space in a small office complex, and I know our VSOs have told me that they really feel the fact that it doesn't feel like a government office is one of the pluses in encouraging men and women to come through the door.
Anything else for Commissioner Hall? Bill, thanks for being with us today.
Thanks so much for the opportunity.
Director Smith.
Welcome. Good afternoon, Co-Chair Johnson, Co-Chair Gomberg, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Cameron Smith, the director of the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs, and pleased to be back before you today for a second phase hearing. Want to start simply, the strength of our agency is based on who we serve, Oregon veterans and their families. An incredible diversity in our veterans community, men and women, young and old, urban and rural, every ethnicity and creed. And we are united as a community, and we've been using this We Are Oregon Veterans moniker. The only thing that I think divides us as a veterans community is which branch we served in. We have Dennis Guthrie here behind me with his fellow members from VFW. Dennis is the chair of our advisory committee, a proud Vietnam veteran, but served in the Army. And it pains me to say that he thinks Marine stands for muscles are required, intelligence not essential. So I'm going to try to disprove that with our support of our budget here today. And I will not make any comments, given our budget, about Representative Reardon's Navy or Representative Meek's Air Force. But definitely, as we're going to do a deeper dive today on our budget and policy option packages with a special focus on Measure 96 and the lottery funds, but please feel free to interrupt with questions as we go. So for the overarching budget, we have in the governor's budget that was released in December 1st, we had about a little over $19 million total funds proposed, both across general fund and lottery fund. Historically, we've had about $10 million general fund. The new Measure 96 revenue, which dedicates 1.5% of net lottery revenues to veterans' efforts, was on the ballot in November. Passed, it was a legislative referral out of this body. 84% passage by the citizens would raise about $18.5 million a biennium projected for this next 17-19 biennium. So roughly would have been 185% surge if all of those are reserved for new efforts.
Excuse me, Director. Senator.
I do want to stop you for two reasons. First of all, to say that this discussion remains a work in progress, and I know that the veterans have, representatives and the folks here in this room have been very faithful in coming and making their views known. There's been a fair amount of emphasis put on the restatement of the co-chair's basic framework, and I think the governor's position is shifting. I just want to reassure folks this remains a work in progress. Yeah. So that's item number one. Item number two is you just acknowledged that this ballot measure is based on a fluctuating revenue source. And I am eager to tease out the general veteran response to the idea of sequestering some of this money to insulate against the vicissitudes of a funding source that is variable. And the reason that I ask this is, coming to the legislature on Monday to begin the work week, that was the day that the new Cowlitz gaming facility in Washington opened. The prognostication is that that facility could peel as much as $100 million out of available lottery revenues. And so you don't have to answer right now, but at least to begin to have you and your advisory committee and veterans groups start to think about what would be the shock absorbers that could be put in place. I mean, there is pressure on putting other lottery facilities around the Portland metro area, and not all of them will be to the benefit of the state of Oregon if there's a proliferation of sites in Washington. So I at least just offer that for consideration, because lottery will fluctuate.
Co-Chair Johnson, members of the committee, we agree wholeheartedly, both to the initial point that the ongoing discussion of what is that mix of general fund and lottery fund. We don't take lightly the budget picture that Ways and Means members in the legislature are weighing. That weighed on the governor in taking some of those general fund resources to help shore up other areas of the budget. The veterans community, in a very powerful and united way, raised and mobilized their voices. And at the end of March, the governor did come to a consensus agreement with the veteran advocates that general fund would be for current service level and that the lottery fund would be reserved for above and beyond. And currently, in the co-chair framework, about $5 million in general fund. So what we're talking about on the ongoing basis throughout the rest of this session is how much more of that general fund, another $5 million to get up to the full 10, is still under discussion. To the point of reserves, in the governor's budget, we were able to carve out about a one-month operating revenue reserve. So we didn't appropriate the full lottery funds up to $18.5 million. As we buy back more of that general fund, we would be short-sighted to not set aside a decent chunk in reserves. It would be you'll hear about great programs today that we do want to fund off lottery fund, but we don't want to be in the business of coming back halfway through the biennium, having raised expectations merely to cut those later.
Follow.
Please.
The other comment that you just made is great programs that you want to fund with this. It has been my observation in my service here at the legislature that when there is money on the table, that all of a sudden there are no shortage of people who want to spend it. And I am quite concerned about what level of screening mechanism you are going to have within the agency to decide what are the programs that are organized and managed and accountable sufficiently to provide real benefit to veterans. There's a propensity in this building to put whatever the name that's associated with the current revenue. It was economic development for a while, and every program was economic development. And what I'm afraid is that pretty soon every program is going to have a patina of veteran service on it because there's money on the table. And I am quite eager to know how you, as the director of the agency, will guard against fly-by-night operations that have zero or little accountability and are more than happy to suck up some of that available revenue in the name of veterans, but with a paucity of real service to veterans.
Co-Chair Johnson, members of the committee, I think while 18.5 of additional new dollars sounds like a significant amount, it goes very quickly when you're talking about investing in proven partnerships and programs that we already have today. All of these funds have to be found in a way that leverages larger resources, whether those are other state systems, whether the federal VA, our county partners, our service organizations. And it's going to be up to us to define those programs and put structures behind them so that it doesn't become, we had a quote on my door for a while from the last hearing of aromatherapy for veterans. There will be any number of random programs that sound great for this beloved population, but we have to find ways to truly structure it to deliver results. And I think we have many, I mean, the county VSO system and our partnership with service organizations has been a 70-plus year model. Some of the newer partnerships you'll have to consider have had some existing proven models. The hard part is on the one-offs organizationally, often a good-hearted nonprofit that thinks they want to serve this population, thinks this is a pot of money for grants, and that hasn't been, unless we truly structure that with an outcome focus, will be difficult to deliver results.
Mr. Director, you're too generous. You say good-hearted not-for-profits. The trail is littered with the bones of the not-so-good-hearted that saw veterans and veterans' money as an easy mark to get charitable Oregonians to make donations, and they were not qualified operations. And I want to make sure that we can guard against having any of those kinds of shenanigans with this newly available money.
And Co-Chair Johnson, members of the committee, I feel a lot of the veterans community does not want to see a dollar of the general fund swept and to truly see these lottery fund dollars go into meaningful efforts. If there's an effort that doesn't feel fully baked at this time, these funds will continue to develop and still be dedicated within that fund. I do not feel the pressure to get, I mean, beginning July 1 is when these lottery dollars begin to collect. We'll have collected that 18.5 over the biennium. If it feels like anything is half-baked, that's when we need to hit pause. They will still be collecting and dedicated for this population.
One last follow-up. Could you describe how your advisory board operates right now? Because we have passed a couple of bills across the Senate floor vesting a great deal of authority and oversight in the advisory group. And I am curious to know, how are they selected? How often are there rotations on and off that board? Is there a prophylactic against any level of self-dealing? Are there governance documents that guide the deliberations of the board? If that advisory board becomes a sounding board for veterans to express their preferences, I think that having a great deal of confidence in the mechanics of that board would be essential.
Co-Chair Johnson, members of the committee, one of the great strengths of our agency is that nine-member advisory committee. We've had it since 1945. Some of the important consideration, I mean, we have the breadth of diversity that we're trying to represent on that board, whether geographically, all eras of service, branches of service, components, National Guard, active duty, and then that expertise in the areas that we're looking for across healthcare, education, economic opportunity. It is an amazing group of citizens. They are appointed by the governor. They have 4-year terms, can be reappointed by the governor for a second 4-year terms. They are not Senate confirmation appointments. When the governor nominates the director of ODVA, the advisory committee essentially has a veto authority over the director of that appointment. After that decision, it is truly an advisory body and a council that we can rely on to get that pulse of the community across the state. So you'll see in our county VSO, in our statutes, in our county VSO pass-through, it is the agency director and ODVA's determination on some of those grants, but in consultation with that advisory member committee. There is one bill that will be coming to House Ways and Means, House Bill 2891, in a way to try to structure some grant-making opportunity in a way that's not for a larger for counties or for student veterans efforts on campus, some of the more discrete ones. This one would position the advisory committee in a decision-making role on those grant-making, a pot of funds for the advisory committee to grant out. It would be one of the first times that we had a decision-making role, not simply a consultation role, and one for the legislature to weigh going forward in terms of governance.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Let's continue.
So again, the co-chair's budget has about $5 million of general fund in, we will. What's interesting is, as you know, the politics of this. It's an interesting time where it feels like veterans are becoming a wedge issue in a way that it never has before, and one that we're trying to navigate going forward. So we've talked a little bit about the costs, but it's also about what this returns. You heard from Commissioner Hall on that economic driver, $2.6 billion a year of federal annual spending in Oregon. Half of that, 1.3, is that cold hard cash coming back on disability compensation and low-income pensions for Oregon veterans. And we know we are leaving those resources on the table and could be drawing down an even greater level of those disability payments. That is one metric. The other benefits on healthcare spending that they'd be eligible for, other federal VA resources. But what is harder for us to measure is the savings on the state general fund. As you get a benefit for a veteran out of the federal VA, often they are coming off of state or local safety net services that are general funded. So this does not come, those federal VA dollars do not come just simply automatically. It does take having that advocate in the corner with those veteran service officers, both at the National Service Orgs and the county veteran service officers. About $10 million a year of general funds has helped fund veteran services, half of which flows down to the county level. And we have been delivering results. So the question, I think it was Representative Reardon and Representative Gomberg, on how are we going to get more of those folks in the door? And Representative Reardon, what does it take to capture a veteran? Just over the last, I mean, it is taking on formal power of attorney and submitting that claim up to the federal VA, which can be a cumbersome process. But over the last, since 2013, almost a 50% surge in new power of attorneys coming to ODVA, and on new claims submitted both by the county VSOs and our statewide veteran service officers, and from 6,000 to over 12,000 claims. So we have, the proof is in the pudding. We are, we have doubled the number of claims that have going back to the federal VA, as well as increasing one of the key performance measures, number three, What is the average compensation per disabled veteran has increased from a little under $14,000 to now over $15,000 over that same time period.
So we're going to interrupt you again. Yes, Senator.
Giving the power of attorney is not an insignificant act, and I have never had question to think about this previously, but when a veteran relinquishes power of attorney to a CVSO, is it for the very narrow purpose of seeking the benefits?
Correct, Co-Chair Johnson, members of the committee. It's a limited power of attorney to advocate on their behalf for the disability compensation.
I know I'm mixing programs, but I would like to come back and ask that same question with respect to the guardianship program and what is done to oversee the guardians and what amount of a veteran's assets can be tapped and for what purposes within a guardianship arrangement. I'm very supportive of guardianships, but absent vigilance, I'm not sure that that isn't an area that's ripe for some abuse, depending on the quality and the integrity of the guardians.
Co-Chair Johnson, members of the committee, it is a much more broader authority in our conservatorship program. Conservatorship much more limited to the financial affairs of the veteran and their family. Guardianship, which we don't offer through ODBA, but have that partnership over to long-term care ombudsman and the public guardian and other guardianship programs, a broader consideration that includes health care and other impacts to the individual. But certainly an area, at least within our conservatorship program, we have seen veterans taken advantage of on the private side and often having that reassurance of having us as the conservator for their affairs.
So, Director, you talked in terms of us increasing the number of raw applications that we are forwarding. But are we making similar improvements in the proportionate number of veterans that we're reaching out to? Are we closing the gap on that 3 or 4 out of 10 I referenced earlier?
And co-chairs, members, Co-Chair Gomberg, members of the committee, we are top-heavy in terms of an aging demographic with over 50% of our veterans from that Vietnam, Korean, World War II era. On a per capita basis, we are continuing to drive that higher. On a raw number, it's going to be challenging over the next 20 years as we lose some of our older veterans. You will see some of the raw numbers begin to come down. We haven't seen that yet, given both the surge of the younger veterans, returning veterans, and then Vietnam veterans reaching a point in their life, either on an income or health side, finally reengaging on the federal VA system.
Thank you.
To break it out specifically, you can find your county on this or some of your major counties on this list, but just an astounding, just off of, so that these are just the state dollars on an annual basis and then the 2015 compensation and pension funds broken out by county. Certainly the counties for the last 70 plus years have also been contributing at that local level, but simply an astounding level. When you think of Clackamas County, roughly they get a little under $200,000 on an annual basis out of the state pass-through dollars, returning just under $100 million a year to Clackamas County. Senator Johnson in Columbia County, only $57,000, returning $20 million on an annual basis. Some of the counties, where they are batting above their weight really comes down to that staffing level, making sure there's a full-time VSO, making sure they have an assistant to make that VSO's time value added, adding that other VSO, not just to ride the desk submitting claims, but to get out to the skilled nursing facilities, to get out to the campuses. It's a big driver in our large population counties like Multnomah, Lane, Washington County, Clackamas County, but also in our smaller counties. When you think in Coos and Curry, $45 million coming into Coos County on an annual basis just on the compensation and pension cash to disabled veterans. And this is still while leaving resources on the table.
And what's the story of Marion County?
So Marion County, so recently Polk County with Representative Neerman's district, both Polk County and Marion County had long been served out of ODVA's Salem Claims Office. They shut down, and it's kind of a lost to history, I think, for much of the reasons. But in the late 70s, early 80s, Marion and Polk stepped away from providing veteran services. And Polk County began January 1 of this year and now is beginning that phase up of their operations. And what's interesting is we've begun to make distinct what is the role at the statewide level for veteran services, what is that boots on the ground county perspective. While ODBA's headquarters is here in Salem, we are not embedded in the community of Marion and Polk County like a county veteran service office was. So Polk County saw a great opportunity both to capture some of those state pass-throughs, but also invest their own funds to make more of a central focus in Dallas County. And next week, we'll be in front of the Marion County Commission with a very similar discussion to see whether Marion County wants to step up as well to establish a county VSO network.
But this chart makes my previous point, and that is, this is the distribution to counties. In some cases, the counties are impecunious. They can't support more money. And I want to go back and renew my question to you. How do we assure equity among the CVSOs? For a whole variety of reasons. First, it's the right thing to do. And secondly, if somebody is being grossly underpaid in X county and can get recruited away by Y county, you'll have piracy for remuneration. And I don't blame the CVSOs. Many of them have families they need to take care of, and they need to earn a decent living. But I'm just trying to figure out, all of them are equally committed to serving the vet. The disparity and the funding formula based on population leaves some counties, I think, in the dust. And look at the amount of return. For Columbia County, that amount of money distributed to counties probably does not cover salary, let alone any support, let alone the ability to get out and meet with folks. And I'm just trying to figure out, how do we treat the CVSOs equitably?
Co-Chair Johnson, members of the committee, no easy answer on that. If they were all statewide, we would lose that benefit of being embedded in the community, but we would have a clearer ability to structure that. Some of it does come down to continually to work with our partners to make sure they are investing, just as we are investing, that they are investing. But you're right that some of the small, I mean, I kind of lump our counties. We have got roughly 6 big ones, 12 medium ones, about 17 smaller ones. It's harder for those smaller ones to step up at levels that the mediums and the big counties can. For our current, how we've currently structured the pass-through, and it is always that balance of large and small, urban and rural, it's been roughly 55% on a base allocation that gets shared equally across any county. Now it will be 35, and if Marion County comes on, 36. 55% based on an equal share, a base allocation, 55% on population metric, and then 40, oh, maybe I've got that mixed up. I'll have to double check. I believe it's 55% on base and then 45% applied by population. And it's that balancing act. When we had that first surge in 2005, 2007 biennium, the biggest benefit was to the smaller and medium counties being able to bring their part-time positions up to full-time, similar out of the $1 million surge out of the 13-15 and 15-17 biennium. And we've got a slide in a little bit. It's not a... it is always going to be that balancing act. And then to try to get quality of services the same across every county, not just on a pay and benefit scale, but making sure the training from that statewide level, making sure the claims review process through our Portland Claims Office as claims are coming up, that quality review is important to make sure they're consistent.
Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Please.
Is there a possibility to look at this as sort of a total comp picture? I was around the periphery of trying to get some base funding. This was with the late Ben Westland a million years ago. But is there a way to centralize bringing the distant CVSOs in for training and have that compensated? Are there other methodologies that make it easier on some of the far away rural counties to have their folks come to Salem so that it, for all of the training that you talked about? And for anybody listening to this, the notion that you just walk in on day one and start as a CVSO is completely incorrect. The level of training that these guys have to put in, the certification, the demonstrated ability to do the work. But I'm just trying to think, is there another methodology that would help lessen the burden? And I don't have a concept for you, but just wondering out loud whether or not some other remuneration formula if there were more money?
Co-Chair Johnson, members of the committee, I think viewing the pass-through dollars are very flexible for the county VSOs today to determine where that they could use those dollars to get to the training conference if that was the short part of their budget. They could use it for outreach. They could use it to staff up. I'm very comfortable with the current oversight. I mean, each county is structured differently, but we've had more engagement out of the community partners and the leadership from the county commissioners and our work with AOC. I trust them to be able to make that decision to make it the best impact out of that county process and with that local veterans engagement. On the training front, we used to have twice a year annual training where everyone would be convened in one spot. It got to be challenging on the budgets, both for those smaller and medium counties. And when we ramped up to two trainers, now being able to take that training regionally out on the show to their neck of the woods has made it value added in addition to the one annual training. And I did want to highlight there are only about four counties that currently contract out their Veteran Service Office function, Union County, Clatsop County, Harney County, and Columbia County. It can help control costs, but also has a little bit of that independent contractor relationship that it is separate and distinct from the county and not always embedded within the county structure.
Follow?
Please.
You're making my point about Clatsop. The CVSO in Clatsop should not have to front-end load expenses and wait to get reimbursed. And
Co-Chair Johnson, members of the committee, I don't think I really realized this before. You had made this point previously. I believe in Clatsop, it's actually an individual who has contracted to be the VSO, vice an organization like a community action or a senior center or another entity. And that one is unique in terms of a one-off that we may need to look at how do we make sure that's not fronting out of his pocket.
Well,
as an individual, vice as an organization.
I'd work with you and the county commissioners to make that equitable. And I don't know, since he first brought it to my attention, whether or not that's been redressed in any way. And shame on me for letting it drift to the bottom of the pile. But out of those four counties that you mentioned, two of them are counties I represent. And I just want to make sure that those guys who work for a very competent not-for-profit, our community, our CAT organization, Community Action Team, that they are paid equitably and treated equitably.
Co-Chair Johnson, members of the committee, the other point, traditionally we've had emergency assistance at the state level. Another model could be to pass those funds through down to the county VSO level for them to make that determination at the local level. It would be a different model, but again, part of that not fronting resources out of pocket, but to use that as a structured fund could be another avenue. So here's the historical costs on veteran services, growing from about $6 million to $10 million general fund. This was the original governor-proposed budget, where you see the $2 million backfilled with lottery dollars and then surging up to about $20 million, vice the $28.5 million, that would be the full. Now she's advocating, and we are advocating for that full general fund on current services, which allows up to that $28.5 million to truly be Measure 96 to expand veteran services. Align sustainable funding, you'll hear, to make sure that home loans is sustainable for us long term and not funding the entirety of our agency. And then that this is not just solely for ODVA and county VSOs, but also the broader possible partnerships that we could have.
Representative Nierman.
So on that slide there, so I don't have the previous slide in the deck on OLIS there. But when I voted for Measure 96, that was what I had in my brain is a chart that looked like that. I mean, I'll give the little non-increase in the general fund money there. I'll give that away. But I think that is the chart that I had in my brain when I voted for 96. I think the voters of the state of Oregon expected that too, and not the previous chart there where we were voting. We said we're voting this lottery money. We don't really care how much veterans get, or we want to give them a little bit of an increase. But what we really care about is it's the source of funds that's important. I don't think that's what the voters of the state of Oregon had in mind. I think they had in mind that increase there. So I'll hope that you can get that worked out in the budget by the time we get you back here.
Thank you, Representative.
Commissioner Hall touched briefly on this. The estimated annual cost for both salary and benefits on a VSO, $78,000. Once they are trained up, returning that $1.7 million on an annual basis. When you roll that forward across 5 years, for less than $500,000 for the cost of a VSO, returning that $27.5 million over a five-year basis. I am biased, but I've never seen that kind of return on any government effort. So the big question becomes, as we consider surging resources above current service level for veteran services, what does that buy us? There are a lot of assumptions that get baked into this. We had a $1 million surge in the last biennium, and we have generated great results. So it's a little disingenuous to say if we only increase by $1 million, we're not going to buy more VSOs. But this slide is based on just the state dollars. If we surged $1 million in state, $2 million, $3 million, $4 million, $5 million, just off of the state investment, when we filter that through the county VSO and service org formula, how many more VSOs do we think would be out there as eyes and ears? And you really begin to see in the higher dollar amounts that you would begin to get over 10, 25, 30 more VSOs out there compared to the about 80 that we have today. And those are going to correspondingly then draw down more of that compensation and pension. And at the lower levels, we would still be making a difference. We would be making someone a full-time. Counties might be incentivized to add their own funds to it. They might buy an assistant. They might put it to the outreach and the broader partnerships. We're still going to be driving forward success on training and claims review. So this is a conservative estimate. At a $3 million level, we think we'd have 10 more VSOs out there. At $4 million, 25, and at $5 million, 35 more VSOs out there. And I would just say it does take a time lag to make sure they are trained up before those returns are generating in that second year. So just again, a summary. In the original governor's budget, we had $1.5 million of surge resources for county VSOs and national service orgs. In our agency request budget, we had about $5.2 million requested. We could easily see a surge up to over $5 million in this area and still be skinning the opportunity. Given the lower levels originally in the governor's budget, we did not add in a trainer or a claims review position. If we do see greater levels of VSO funding for pass-through, we would want to make sure that we're not the bottleneck on the training of those new VSOs or on the claims review through our Portland team. The other two positions that were in there, the representative payee position in our conservatorship program, it's a lesser level bill paying function, not taking full control over the financial affairs, but helps keep 150 veterans independent and not in institutions and very value added. And then an aging veteran services outreach position at the statewide level as well was in the governor's budget.
Mr. Chair.
Please.
Is the payee position a bonded position?
Co-Chair John, a bond position?
A bonded.
I'd have to double check on the representative payee. Certainly, our conservators do have. I, as the conservator, have that bond.
Okay.
The other major portion in this POP 102 for veteran services is program stabilization, which we'll speak to in the home loan section. The only other I would highlight, there is a veteran volunteer coordinator position that was not in the governor's budget. House Bill 2908 will be coming to Ways and Means. Very similar to the long-term care ombudsman and the CASA program, how do we not just solve the problem of connecting veterans to their benefits through full-time positions, whether at the county level or state level, but ensuring we're mobilizing the broader volunteer network and the sea of goodwill that does exist for veterans, could be a powerful concept to mobilize a core of supporters to get out there on the outreach function and drive more of that work to the professional VSOs. So on the partnerships front, Measure 96 was never geared solely for ODVA empire building or veteran services empire building. And when we were putting together our work, we saw three key areas that are impacting our population of veterans and their families but not always our core expertise delivered out of ODBA. On the mental health front, while we're only about 9% of all Oregonians as veterans, we're almost a quarter of all suicides in this state. On the education front, we've done so much work to try to connect veterans to their benefits, but not as much work trying to honor that veteran's strength as they come home, recognizing the challenge of that transition on campus, but better supporting veterans on campus was a big effort that we wanted to focus on. And then housing and homeless veterans, almost 1,500 homeless veterans across the state, half of whom are unsheltered on any given night, another key area that we wanted to focus on out of the partnership resources. On the mental health care front, so much work has been going on in the Oregon Health Authority and broader health, a lot of uncertainty in the healthcare world. It's been hard to get as much traction on some peer-to-peer delivered models that would benefit veterans. But one possible partnership to consider is stable and ongoing funding for the suicide crisis line that is dedicated for military and veterans. Over the last two biennia, we've had a great partnership with Lines for Life, making sure that there's a cultural specific resource for veterans and military and their family members to call, and getting great results. Approximately has been about $350,000 in the current biennial budget. On student veteran efforts, we've long had a partnership through our statewide efforts and with our VSOs. With the student veteran coordinators and centers on campuses, we've seen many of the campuses stand up as more veterans are coming back, almost over 10,000 veterans using the GI Bill and other federal VA scholarship programs, $145 million that are flowing back onto campuses every year for scholarships for veterans. We could be doing more to make sure that we're getting good outcomes for those veterans. Senate Bill 143 is the current policy vehicle for this partnership and would structure a grant program to better get out like we have expanded and enhanced county VSO networks, to expand and enhance the existing campus veterans resource programs and coordinators, and further encourage campuses to stand up more.
Mr. Chair.
Please.
Do those campus veterans officers have the same degree of rigor in their training so that they could be a portal to get benefits, or are they just some guy that shows up in the office?
Co-Chair Johnson, members of the committee, previously we did have a model in the 2009-11 biennium of a pilot where it was essentially campus VSOs that were trained to the level to be able to submit claims to the federal VA. What we found was it created a duplicative system that we were strengthening the counties and the service orgs at the same time trying to do that on campus. Today, the model is those student veteran coordinators are embedded on the staffs of those individual institutions, but more from that resource and student life side of the house, not necessarily being that link to submit claims, but they are that hub of the wheel and strong relationships then outgoing to the VSOs to submit those claims on their behalf.
Let me ask a more nuanced question. Who has supervisory control over those folks, or does it vary by institution? Is there any requirement that they check in with you and kind of the mothership? How do you know that they are performing up to expectations and that they're delivering information that is timely, accurate? Those are important portals of information, and absent some degree of uniform training, you could have somebody out there with all kinds of bad info. And I'm just trying to figure out how you maintain quality control, for lack of a better word.
Co-Chair Johnson, members of the committee, while we've got strong relationships, no formal authority between us and those student veteran coordinators today. Imagined out of Senate Bill 143, I think we would get more of that structure if we had that dedicated student veteran liaison position at ODBA it would be that convener trying to infuse that standard operating practice across the facility, across the universities and community colleges. But most often, it is embedded within the dean of student life, similar to a women's center or a first-time college support program, and is that hub of the wheel for this community on campus.
Thank you.
The last area in terms of mobilizing partnerships on the housing and homelessness front, in 2009, we had the recording fee at $15 going into housing efforts. In 2013, we had an additional $5 that was added by the legislature, but dedicated to veterans housing efforts. These funds go through the Oregon Housing and Community Services Agency. Into three primary buckets: the emergency housing effort with about 10% of the funds, the first-time home ownership with about 14% of the funds, and then general housing development fund with about 76% of the funds. So we have an existing model where resources are currently going into housing and homeless efforts dedicated to veterans. And the two that we would call out are both that emergency housing area and then also the general housing area. Emergency housing most often leverages the community action networks that are statewide, rapid rehousing programs, transitional housing, preventing homelessness, and actually providing shelter for those who are homeless. If we are looking at lower dollar amounts, that is a good area to ramp up. Currently, they get about $709,000 has been generated in this biennium for the emergency housing just for veterans through that recording fee, isn't just to get a raw dollar amount. On the general housing front, which is the larger bucket, they've had two primary projects. About $4 million has been raised so far from the recording fee, and two primary projects, both in Klamath Falls and Medford, actually building capacity. The Klamath Falls had about 11 beds that were created, and Medford had about 10. So much larger dollar amounts. So how many beds get created, but powerful leverage to try to create more affordable housing in communities across the state, dedicated for veterans and in such a way that leverages the HUD-VASH voucher, that is the rental assistance piece longer term. Great models that we've seen out of Multnomah County and Lane County, essentially ending a functional zero of veterans homelessness, where the number of veterans homelessness that come forward are able to find those long-term affordable housing options as a first start.
I'm doing a dangerous thing, which is to draw again anecdotally on my own district that I know so well. And one of the difficulties that we are having is regularizing this relationship with HUD and the NOAA vouchers. There is so little available housing in Columbia County that I have a mom with four kids that we're working on living in her car, had gotten a NOAA voucher. It had expired the first time and they renewed it. It expired the second time because she couldn't find a place and they told her no. And had it not been for intervention by the community action team, she'd be back in her car. And so I just want to suggest to you, and maybe as part of your training with the CVSOs, to figure out if you're working on housing issues, what are the rules of engagement with HUD? And depending on who the regional HUD authority is, for us it's the Northwest Oregon Housing Authority, what are their rules of engagement with respect to the durability of those vouchers? It's heartbreaking to work your way up on the list and finally get the voucher in hand and there's no available housing and the voucher gets taken away and you go right back down to the bottom, even with children.
Co-Chair Johnson, members of the committee, that has been the frustration similarly out of the HUD-VASH vouchers. And it is a missed opportunity when you can't place someone that has that rental assistance into the available housing. What seems to have worked in some communities, working with the landlords to really prioritize this population at one level, but then again also comes back that it's not just about rental assistance through that emergency housing effort, but truly trying to build capacity over the long term that then is dedicated as an avenue. So those two new projects, those now within that community, can take advantage of those HUD-VASH vouchers that are dedicated with that match of an actual affordable housing development. So Oregon Housing and Community Services continues to emphasize building out that capacity.
Let me stop you there for a second. When you say building out that capacity, for those of us that represent rural places, our concern is that of all the money that is coming through the legislature, that rural places get a bite at that apple. And what I'm concerned about is that we're losing track of the possibility of housing preservation. It's not building the new shiny stuff, but it's keeping venerable old properties serviceable. And the second thing is that, no disrespect to my urban colleagues, but the fact that there seems to be an attitude in this building that we take care of Portland first, and I think some of us just want to make sure that if you're working with your sister agency, that there are relationships that span the geographic breadth of our state, and that all, in your case, vets get a bite at the apple. It's not just urban vets.
Co-Chair Johnson, members of the committee, point very well taken, and I'd have to double check, but I believe out of that general housing category, I don't know that it is solely for new developments. And I would concur that often in our rural communities, just the complexity of a new project and the financing and matching it all together can be a bridge too far if the organizational capacity is not there. And how do we use some of those general housing dollars for acquisition of existing housing stock, fixing them up, and still having them be dedicated to veterans that you could match? It's just a different model of matching that HUD-VASH rental assistance with an available unit. It's another model that we'd be excited to pilot in conjunction with OHCS. So we had in governor's budget about $3 million of the lottery funds dedicated to broader partnership efforts. This was a specific emphasis out of the governor's change and in listening to the veterans community, really wanting to drive both those surge resources into veteran services, but also to drive those dollars into housing to really see that we could end veterans homelessness statewide. So those great investments and leveraged investments across veteran services and the partnerships, this is our emphasis on the importance of maintaining reserves at the higher level amounts as we buy back general fund. Would not be unprudent or imprudent to set aside $2 million or more to make sure that we aren't over-promising out of these lottery funds in this next biennium. As we've seen, in historic time periods, whether it was the smoking ban or new casinos coming online, the possibility of online gaming in the future, lottery goes in waves just naturally, and then also over the long term. And we want to make sure that we have that working capital and good financial stewardship to make sure that we're not making cuts in future years. And I think we said CFO recommended, but I think also a heavy emphasis at a legislative fiscal office. So on the home loans front, this is our program, longest running program since 1945, the original constitutional amendment voted on by Oregon citizens to make sure, separate and distinct from the federal VA loan, which is a zero down, that we offer a below market interest rate home loan to veterans. It's only one of five. Oregon is only one of five states grandfathered under the federal tax law, and the primary funding vehicle is those tax-advantaged qualified veteran mortgage bonds that we sell to fund those loans. Cumulatively, over the lifetime, over 300,000 individual veteran loans made, almost $8 billion of home loans made since 1945. We do have qualified veteran mortgage bonds do come with some restrictions. They can only be used for veterans within 25 years of their discharge. We do have a smaller amount of pre-Allman funds that are more flexible, but are not limitless. And even with our financial wizardry of recycling those, they will slowly go away. And we will be left primarily with QVMBs as the funding source for all loans. Important to note, in 2010, we had Measure 70, which made the Oregon Home Loan Program a lifetime benefit. We have not matched that necessarily with a funding source. Today, we are able to make those loans to those beyond 25 years with pre-Allman funds. As that runs out, we will not have a stable funding source for beyond the 25-year veterans. On the next slide, which is breathtaking, the size of the program today is about 10% of what it was in the 1980s. There was a time when ODVA was the second largest lender, second only to the federal government. Today, about $300 million of outstanding state general obligation debt and for that portfolio, and a mix of fixed and variable rate debt. So here is the snapshot picture from 1953 to today. And incredibly, on the left-hand side column, that is in billions. So $1, $2, $3, $4, $5 billion. In the early 80s, we were almost a $5 billion loan portfolio. And that is in early 1980 dollars. Today, it's that is about a quarter of the general fund lottery fund revenue today, and had the full faith and credit of the state of Oregon backing it. A massive ramp up, both of the number of accounts on the blue line, upwards of over 140,000. Right at the time, high interest rates in the market, we were the best deal in town, and then combined with that early 80s recession and the timber economy, a huge unwinding from that peak in the 80s down to that current level of today, about 2,000 loans on the books, and even at that tiny level, about $270 million as a total loan portfolio. But you can see what was a program, the home loan program, that has long funded our core operations and veteran services historically. What it could sustain at the peak, being a $5 million program, is vastly different than what it can sustain today at that $270 million portfolio. While it's a little, it makes it seem like we're shutting the program down on this slide, by no means. We have finally stabilized in terms of number of accounts, and we'll begin slowly growing that number back again. And origination since 2013, after that depths of the housing recession, beginning to climb. The total portfolio beginning to climb off of historic originations of about $60, $70 million a year.
Co-chair Bauer.
Yes, I'm sorry, I didn't see you. Thank you, that's okay.
Director Smith, thank you very much. The home ownership programs are very near and dear to my heart, and I know that I've helped several veterans work and purchase a home with the veterans loan, but the Oregon VA loan is much more actually friendly, allows them to have a more leverage to purchase more of a home. And so I know that a lot of them will look for the access of these loans, but a lot of times they're already, your allowance is already gone or they're not available. But so I encourage the continued support of the Oregon VA loan. Because it does help our Oregon vets, and it's a great opportunity for stability and for them to really kind of settle down and get back into their community after serving. So thank you.
Co-chairs, Representative Meek, thank you for that. And I don't know that we're turning anyone away at our current rates. We have had to tighten up the interest rate. It's not as lower for the pre-Allman funds, but still a great rate on that below market for the QVMB side. And as you mentioned, one of the great benefits of the home loan program that we are the servicer of those home loans and not selling that loan off. So often we have a lot more flexibility to manage through when a veteran can't make that payment and make sure they get back on track. So this slide shows that well below for a home loan, both the 90-day delinquent or in foreclosure status, much lower than conventional FHA or federal VA loans.
Thank you.
So this is the operating cost of the home loan program. We have had significant, from the 80s on, we used to be 600 strong as full-time employees at ODVA, now about 88 folks. But within the home loan program itself, in that significant reduction in 11-13 on staffing, and then also a significant reduction in 2003 as well. But part of the concern is that approximately $4.1 million is not specific to the home loan program, but is helping subsidize both veteran services and core agency operations. So out of those lottery funds, we have proposed to take about $4 million to align these costs so that Veteran Services helps share its share of the costs of operations for the agency, both to preserve that amount, both to preserve the home loan program and not put any general obligation debt at risk and make sure that anything that's generated off of the home loan program goes to pay off those bonds. But to also make sure that our other core functions are sustainably funded in the future. We would be very hesitant to create new surges in new programs if we weren't aligning these costs now on the home loan program while we have this historic opportunity. Over the last 6 years, ODVA, through the home loan program, has lost about $13 million, primarily because of that subsidy funding non-home loan costs. This is a similar conversation that we've seen at Oregon Housing and Community Services as some of their revenues from their programs have changed, the challenge to be able to sustain their core operations off of that funding source. Any questions on our alignment? So a decent chunk, $4 million within that POP 102, is that funding alignment. And again, it is not new work. It is simply changing the color of money that would be paying for that work. And a good way to make sure that we are stabilizing that home loan program and ensuring its revenues are making that program a success for the next 70 plus years. So while we have been highlighting some of the policy option packages and the budget conversations here at Ways and Means, often we can overemphasize what raw dollars can do. Ultimately, at any funding level that we are fortunate to receive, we have to make sure that we're bringing our leadership to bear. And it is our core strategic goals of targeting veteran services, mobilizing partnerships, driving veteran engagement, invigorating core operations. At whatever funding level that we are fortunate to receive, we're going to continue to drive our efforts. When we've looked at the partnership across the county and the state, when we've emphasized training within Target Veteran Services, the claims review that we are now doing on all claims that come up through ODVA, now having a fully electronic claims process from the county on up to us to be able to submit that to the federal VA, slowly but surely the federal VA is getting there electronically on the claims submission. And a really strong partnership that we've developed with the Association of Oregon Counties and our national service organizations. At the partnership level, across DHS and OHA, doing more and more that we can to identify folks that are on those state safety net services and making sure that we're then driving them into the Veteran Services channel. The work that we've done with the Department of Corrections and Incarcerated Veteran Outreach, our work on housing and homelessness efforts with partners, and also our efforts across tribal veterans. The driving veteran engagement, simply the awareness for our veterans community, what are the resources out there, making sure we're bringing our stories and photos and brand to the blog, social media, our print and online communications. Focused outreach across women veterans, LGBTQ, aging veterans, our rural efforts through the Highly Rural Transportation Grant, making sure that we are meeting veterans where they are and where they are in their life. And then still bringing all to bear, both on cost containment and making sure we're effective and efficient across our team, whether it's from the IT side of the house, whether it's as we stood up our second veterans home in Lebanon, or whether we continue to drive originations out of the home loan. But we appreciate this opportunity to come before you and happy to answer other questions.
And do we have questions for the director?
I would say, Mr. Director, that was an efficient use of time, and I know that we are going to come back tomorrow and conclude this conversation. So let me, with that in mind, I'm going to go ahead and conclude for today the public hearing on House Bill 5039.
Madam Co-Chair.
May I ask, Mr. Director, if you would bring us a list of the advisory committee and give it to the professional staff to give to the whole committee here?
Anything else for the good of the order? Well, Mr. Director, contrary to your remarks at the beginning of your program, I would say that mental agility is recognized in a nimble expository today.
Thank you.
And that being said, colleagues, we will reconvene tomorrow at 1300. That's 1 o'clock for civilians. And we are adjourned. And we are adjourned.